Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape.
Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ihsan Higgins here. We've got a very, very special lineup this evening, very exciting lineup. And as you all know, during this period of lockdown and COVID-19 in the news, you know, we've had programs pertaining to COVID-19 and lockdown since the start of lockdown and through the Ramadan as well. So yeah, tonight is no different. We're speaking to some guests, very, very important and special guests tonight, about, you know, the about the lockdown, about the COVID-19, and, you know, the Disaster Management Act. And tonight we have the lineup. It starts off with none other than former Ambassador Ibrahim Rasool, former Premier of the Western Cape as well. And he's going to be talking us through a whole lot of issues pertaining to the pandemic issues. Assalamu alaikum, Ibrahim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Ihsan, and to all the listeners of the Voice of the Cape. It's nice to be on again.
Yeah, no, it's quite strange hearing you on the line as opposed to sitting here in studio. The only thing that's looking at me right now, quite weirdly, is two bottles of hand sanitizers, and it says the 75% alcohol on each bottle. So I've never thought that I'll ever see the day that I'll be sitting in Voice of the Cape studio looking at alcohol. So
look, I think it is better that the alcohol goes into the sanitizers than into the people of South Africa.
Yeah.
I think we have a wonderfully sober nation at this moment, and we have absolutely clean hands. So yeah. Even in the bad days, good.
Yeah, no, but as I say, it's just weird sitting in this empty room and only alcohol staring at me. But yeah. Coming back to the program, Ibrahim, shukran for firstly agreeing to come on this late. I know it's late, and I know, you know, Dr. Yusuf does us a great service by being on E, you know, during the week between 9 and 11. So I've got one of the slots, you know, that he's kindly offered, you know, for me to deal with some of these issues. So, yeah, it's late, but we're going to talk about some serious issues. I believe that you just came off a conference now on Zoom commemorating Malik al-Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X. Is that correct?
So let me tell you about being late.
Okay.
That conference starts at 7 p.m. U.S. time.
Okay.
It will be 1 a.m. South African time, so I'm still going to be up until probably 2, 3 in the morning on that commemoration. Okay. So it's still to come.
No, I thought it was South African time, but oh, okay.
No. That's U.S. Eastern time.
Okay,
So anyway,
I suggest you must stay up for Fajr one time.
Inshallah.
Okay. Anyway, Ibrahim, coming to the issue of the Disaster Management Act, and look, you've been a politician for a very long time. I think the public out there they're very confused right now in terms of what exactly is happening now in terms of processes. We have a Disaster Management Act that was obviously promulgated by Parliament, and now you have a group appointed by the President to be this Command Council, and they're making certain regulations in terms of this Disaster Act. So the constitutionality of these regulations has been called into question by various parties. What is your take on it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that that it is instructive that the President is utilizing the Disaster Management Act, because that is limited in time and limited in scope, meaning that it can't go on forever, and also that it doesn't affect everything. Had the President, for example, invoke the emergency regulations, Then South Africans are going to be asked to give up civil liberties. They're going to be asked to not only be in lockdown, but they're going to be in curfew whole day. The police and the army become your instructors. You don't even have a committee making decisions. You simply have a security arrangement making decisions. So we've got to understand that we are not dealing with emergency regulations. We are dealing with disaster management. Emergency regulations deal with issues like civil unrest, security issues, whereas disaster is relating to natural disasters or health disasters, as in this case. And so we have that first distinction. Secondly, I think that the president has put together the National Command Center, and those are the few ministers. And as per the Disaster Management Act, that is coordinated by the Minister of Local Government, or in our case, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. And so all in all, I think that that is correct.
I think we've lost Ibrahim there. We're going to try to get him back. Ibrahim Rasool, he will be back shortly. I see the technician is contacting him now. So we'll get him back now, and we'll continue our discussion pertaining to the constitutionality of the Disaster Management Act and its regulations. And I think, is he back on the line? Okay. Ibrahim, are you back? But anyway, we'll be back.
I'm glad that's good. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, but you were saying?
Yes, I was saying that we've got to first distinguish between the Disaster Management Act and the emergency regulations. Secondly, we have to understand that in terms of that, the president has established the National Command Council, or the NCC, but we are sitting with a situation in which...
In which?
So basically, what we have is a situation in which the president ensures that cabinet as a whole ratifies the decisions of the NCC before they are even implemented, and therefore it is not delegating any authority to any other body other than cabinet. So that, I think, is the second very important very important consideration that we must bear in mind.
Okay, get it straight. So I think the confusion was, if one read the media and all the hype, was that there was simply the command council that made decisions that was implemented. What you're saying now is they make a recommendation to cabinet. Is that what you're saying?
They make decisions, and then before it can be implemented, it is taken to cabinet. And you will remember the last speech that the president made. He said, I want to go to level 3 by the end of May, but cabinet will now be seized with all the discussions that will go into that decision.
Okay.
So that is the way in which you ratify the decision of a committee that sits with the crucial ministers leading their clusters. Thirdly, the third issue that I think one must understand is that even as these things go on, Parliament, for example, has called in the relevant committees and the relevant officials dealing with various aspects of COVID-19. So they, for example, there were complaints that the security forces were being too harsh. Parliament would then call in the heads of departments of the police as well as the army to interrogate them about those kind of matters. So in that way, Parliament plays an oversight role, while before they were giving birth to the Disaster Management Act by empowering the president to utilize that kind of act. So I think it's a more complex way in which our democracy is working, but it is working, and I think it is at the hand of this that quite a few bodies have withdrawn their threats of challenging the constitutionality of the Disaster Management Act and the NCC.
Okay, I think just repeat the part where you say that what is the current role of Parliament? Because it almost seems that, if, you know, if one watches the media, that Parliament is absolutely silent. So can you just repeat the role that Parliament is playing right now?
So Parliament plays an oversight role. So when, for example, there were complaints that the police and the soldiers were being too harsh, were doing bad things to people, Parliament was able to call in the directors general, the heads of the army, etc. And that's what they do over Zoom conferences, to be able to hold them to account and to give direction on how they should be doing. So you don't have Parliament as a whole sitting in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually the committees that deal with the COVID-19 that is then held accountable by the parliamentary portfolio committees that deal with some of those matters.
Yeah, I think it's important that the public understand that democracy is still working. You know, there's been so many silly extracts of news where people almost gave the impression, you know, that democracy is no longer happening in South Africa. I mean, it's now been taken over by a small elite group of politicians. But the way you put it out now, you know, it kind of, you know, fits together nicely.
You see, that is why you go back to the beginning, that if this were based on the emergency regulations, democracy is effectively suspended.
Mm-hmm.
And we experienced that in 1985, 1986, etc., where there's no democracy and P.W. Botha ruled with an iron fist. This is not like that.
Mm.
You can't be locked up without a trial. Even those who violate the compliance of the lockdown are subjected to court procedures. I, under a state of emergency, had no court procedures. I was simply locked away for more than a year.
Mm.
So I think we need to understand that this is not a subversion of democracy or civil liberties, but it is acting in an urgent way to deal with a disaster.
Okay, so I think that's kind of clear in terms of, you know, how this thing plays itself out. And I think people are, of course, very angry about certain things, and the ends, obviously, all the accusations come out. Like, for instance, the ban on cigarettes, the stifling of movement, all the type of restraints that has been put in place. Is there any light for those people, and excuse the pun, you know, like with the cigarettes?
I think where we must question, and we can question, is the rationality of the regulations. We must not question whether the intention is right to save lives, whether the Disaster Management Act is constitutional, and all of those kind of things. What we can debate is the rationality of the regulations. So, for example, the goods that can be sold. All of us have different opinions about whether it's rational or not. And I think what was very important, everyone was looking in the last address by the president to the nation, everyone was looking at an announcement from him. The most important part of what the president did that night was effectively to apologize to the nation for incoherence in government, about one minister speaking like this and another one speaking like that, about regulations not always being rational and sensible, and he undertook that we will get it right. And that is why he expressed his intention to go to level 3 at the end of May, and therefore effectively put the whole of government on notice. You've got 2 weeks to get this thing right, to make sure that we don't contradict each other, to make sure that we speak with one voice, to make sure that what we say is going to be rational, and it's not going to be the whim of a minister or a premier or an MEC or a mayor, that we are going to speak with one voice and we are going to have rational reasons. So I think that that is a debate. And so cigarettes, for example, is definitely a debate, because we can't solve all our issues with one coronavirus lockdown disaster act. I think we would need to, at some point, to just open the valve so that you don't confuse what people are angry with. Sometimes a withdrawal symptoms from being off cigarettes can make you angry at the whole government. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to compound a health disaster with a social uprising, with dissent in the ranks, with civil disobedience. And so government has to clearly balance out a variety of factors. And we must understand, this is like flying an aeroplane. Every button you touch affects another function in the aeroplane. So if you say, let's lift the lid on cigarettes. Cigarettes, for example, is about the health of your respiratory system. If that is weak, you become an even bigger recipient of potential risk for coronavirus. And so you've got to understand, you can't just push a button. You've got to weigh up. Okay, if we open up schools, it's okay for the kids, but what about the teachers? So you've got to balance out there. If you open up alcohol, for example, the reports across the country is that trauma and emergency units have never been so empty on a Friday night, a Saturday, and it's purely related to the fact that alcohol is not being utilized. And so if you fill up trauma and emergency because you open up alcohol, what happens if the wave hits us with COVID and the hospitals are filled with people with stab wounds, with gunshot wounds, wives who have been brutalized by their husbands because of alcohol? So you've got to look at all of those kind of differences. I think the same thing, it's not to make opposites of the economy and health, but to harmonize the competing interests of both.
And also, Ibrahim, the issue of the black market having open for cigarettes. I mean, you see some people are even openly advertising 170 rand a packet of cigarettes, which would, of course, under normal circumstances, about 25 rand. So the black market and the policing of that, I mean, surely. What is your take on that?
Well, that's exactly the thing. If you make a regulation, you must have the mechanism to enforce it. And the mechanism, for example, the president made the announcement about 350 rand for unemployed people. But the mechanisms weren't put in place. The intention was good. The regulation was excellent. But the ability to dispense the money wasn't thought through. In much the same way on cigarettes. If you're going to make that, don't have unintended consequences. And so I think these are all the things that's going into the wash with government. So that when we come to a level 3 situation, we may find a way in which to deal with a situation where the unintended consequences of a burgeoning black market, a loss of tax revenue for government, addicts for cigarettes going crazy, all of those things would need to be carefully calibrated. So I think when the president says, we are going to do things better, it means we are going to look at this aeroplane's dashboard and work a lot more carefully with all the different buttons that are there. We can't just push a button, otherwise the aeroplane nosedives or we lurch to the left or to the right. So I think these are the complex art of managing a disaster like this.
And then, Ibrahim, there's a big issue which we're going to speak about a little bit later with Ashraf Mohammed after I've spoken to you. But maybe you can just comment on it. There's currently, on the cards, bylaws that will be implemented or enacted very soon by the city of Cape Town. Now, isn't it a poor timing on the part of a local government to actually open up a process that could potentially criminalize poverty. Can you, are you familiar with this, with this bylaw that is being looked at?
I've heard about it. It sounds like an omnibus bylaw that kills many birds with one stone, and it's disingenuous. For example, to try and smuggle in a whole lot of different factors in a situation in which people are traumatized because they're losing their jobs, they're having to stay at home, Muslims can't go to Tarawih, Christians couldn't do Easter, Pesach wasn't a thing for Jews. And so when people are assailed with a whole lot of different traumas, you don't. And I know in politics, there's an adage that says, never let a good crisis go to waste. And it seems as if the city of Cape Town is saying, this is a crisis, let's pounce on it, and let's push through a whole lot of things that we want to do. The city of Cape Town and the Western Cape needs to understand, you can't solve in a crisis what you have not been able to sort out in 20 years. And therefore, for example, we can't moan about Khayelitsha not observing social distance when we've not spent all the housing budget to provide more housing for people to overcome the overcrowding in places like Ravensmead, Manenberg, Khayelitsha, etc., because social distance is a relative concept. And in much the same way, the kind of getting street people off the poverty, stopping noise pollution, if it includes. And then we mustn't also fall for the trick in which they satisfy us. They say, no, don't worry, your Adans will be okay. And then we lose sight of the other infringements of people's right to be on the streets, to seek out a livelihood amidst their poverty. So I think this is not very good, but Ashraf Mohammed, I think, will be able to speak much more to the listeners.
Yeah, well,
but I think we mustn't be divided in this. We must see it as a whole.
No, definitely. And I also think it's a bit short-sighted to actually side with a portion of the harm that that this piece of legislation could potentially cause in the communities. But anyway, that's for the debate after this, after my discussion with you. Then, of course, the issue of travel. I mean, you are probably one of the most well-traveled people in the world. So tell us a little bit about what happens to the future of travel.
Look, I think that travel is going to be one of those very difficult situations. Airlines are going under at an alarming rate. There are still countries that allow this kind of travel. The U.S., for example, aeroplanes are still flying there. It's limited in other places. It's absent in other places. And it's no wonder that you are having those countries that are allowing it having the highest rates of infections and of deaths. Because, you see, the nature of the aeroplane is such, it circulates the breath and the air and the droplets of the people in the aeroplane. It doesn't go out. It doesn't take air from outside in. It's a closed circuit. And that's what makes traveling a dangerous matter. It's no wonder that even ships, cruise ships, were hit the hardest. So it's in those kind of areas where of travel that things are very, very tough.
Yes.
And so we know that there are industries wanting to survive, the hospitality industries, but I also think that we are beginning to learn the limits of travel at this moment, and that's why Zoom is taking off. We're now beginning to understand that you could do a Malcolm X commemoration address from Cape Town when the African-American communities across the U.S. can listen to you. You don't have to necessarily fly there. I think people are adjusting for travel, but there are hardy industries.
Yeah, but now, of course, you can't do a Zoom Hajj. So, So what in the future of Hajj? Obviously, there's not going to be, I mean, I don't know if there's been any announcement at this point in time. But if there's, of course, going to be a ban on flying, then, of course, people will not be able to get to the Middle East. So what is your take on that?
Well, look, I think that there have been occasions, rare occasions, but there have been occasions in which for public safety, public health, Hajj was suspended. We're not speaking about an indefinite suspension. There are things that you must do in person. Hajj and Umrah would be one of those kind of matters. And I'm sure that the Saudis, between the revenue accruing from Hajj, the obligations that pilgrims have towards their Creator, as well as the safety of people, you know, in some senses, life is a maqsid, an intent that trumps other obligations, and therefore, I think in much the same way that we are preserving life by forfeiting salah in jama'ah in the masjid, I think the same kind of flexibility would occur with regard to the Hajj, on the basis that the sooner we beat this virus, the sooner we can return to a kind of way in which Hajj becomes again the order of the day.
Yeah, I think people have, you know, when we started out with lockdown, people were focused on wanting to do what they did before. But now that it hasn't happened for a while, and of course there's been a few unsuccessful court challenges to some of these lockdown regulations, especially the one the going to mosque one. I think people are now embracing what they can do instead of going to mosque. You know, in terms of if you look at all the Eid issues, like how people will be having an Eid program despite not being able to go to mosque. So is this part of the, let's call it the acceptance part, you know, that we're in this pandemic and, you know, people need to make the most of it?
You see, I think what we are beginning to find is how do you salvage the intent, the maqsid, the principle, the values? How do we salvage that even if we compromise on the form, what we do? How do we become spiritual if we don't follow every ritual that we are used to? And I'm telling you, just from speaking to people, this has been a very meaningful Ramadan. Family, yet no imam. Because where we were followers before was it Khanna di Travi. Now we are the imams. And suddenly Mujifamak. Suddenly you've got to find the meaning, Jemuti Darsmak, for your family. And I'm amazed how in the intimacy of some of our rituals now under COVID-19, we have found a deep spirituality and a deep meaningfulness. And maybe we may not go on Hajj, but if Hajj is Arafah, and Arafah means to know, and the condition of knowing Allah is to know yourself, I suspect that we have all been in the cave of Hira. Not in the same way that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was in the cave of Hira, but metaphorically we were in the cave of Hira where we sat with the Quran, where we allowed the Quran to speak to us, to our needs, to our desires, to our worries, to our traumas, and to allow the conversation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be one that is shaped by us and not necessarily shaped by the one who gives the lecture afterwards, who gives the interpretation afterwards. And I think we are finding a situation in which people are finding new meanings. It doesn't mean that we will give up on the rituals again like we did it before and the traditions. But the moment we get back to it, we would have reached new depths of meaning and spirituality that could only enhance us. And we will look back on this period and say, really, I was in my own cave of Hira, and I was moved by my spirituality and my connectedness to Allah. And maybe this is what Allah does. Allah interrupts us. Allah says, you've been doing this for so many years in this way or the other. I've not seen you grow. Maybe I'll disrupt you so that you come to know yourself. Then you will come to know me. And that is the very purpose of what these ibadat are about. So we've always been very good at our vertical worship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I think now we've just combined it all. We are such good-hearted, charitable people that the Muslim community is now known across the globe as a giving one. People who make sacrifices, whose zakah is making an impact, whose fitrah will make an impact, whose fidyah will make an impact, whose sadaqah has made an impact. And I believe that that is a benefit that we will all look out for. And inshallah, I'm hoping that the Salt River Initiative that was announced by Eid will make us so together in our apartness that if we can pull off a unified, synchronized takbir on Eid morning, and the whole of Cape Town observes this, and they hear this takbir over the loudspeakers, people stepping out, as suggested by the Salt River people, onto their stoops and doing the takbir. If Voice of the Cape comes to this party, I believe we will look back and say,
and the other radio
how
station.
Is possible?
And the other radio station as well.
And all the, whoever, I think we just need everyone. This can be an aid of healing, of reconciliation, and of unity. Those who have not spoken, organizations that have been suspicious of each other, can reconcile in a common suffering. Those who have the issues with COVID, it could be a prayer for healing for our home nation, not just for ourselves. And so I think we will find benefits, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says to us, sometimes something appears bad to you, but there's good in it. And sometimes the good that we used to do, that there may be have been bad in it, that we became complacent. We became neglectful. We became neglectful of searching for deeper meanings. We did out of habit rather than out of intent.
No, brilliant. I think we need that type of positive voices. Shukran very much for that input in terms of, you know, the challenges that we face at the moment. So, Ibrahim, shukran very much for coming on air this time of the evening also. And we hope to hear your voice very soon, inshallah.
Inshallah, inshallah. What's up? Thank you very much, Ihsan, for this opportunity and to the listeners. And may everyone have a wonderful Eid, inshallah. And may Laylatul Qadr really empower us when it hits us at the right time, inshallah.
Shukran, shukran. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour. Ihsan Higgins here, and we just spoke to former ambassador of the USA, Ibrahim Rasool, and he gave us a bit of positive affirmation in terms of where we're at this point in South Africa. So the next person that we're interviewing tonight is none other than attorney Ashraf Mohammed. Assalamu alaikum, Ashraf.
Wa alaikum salam, Ihsan, and assalamu alaikum to all the listeners, and thank you for having me on your show.
Always a pleasure, Ashraf.
And Ramadan Mubarak to you and to all the listeners as well.
Shukran for that. Ashraf, you've been a very busy man, very busy lawyer over this this lockdown period, and I've been following some of the work that you've been doing. I think it's excellent, you know, that some people have, decided to make the most of the lockdown in terms of the activism, in terms of what they do for society. And, you've done quite a bit. So let's talk about some of it. And most importantly, we're going to talk tonight about this act, or rather this act of, I don't even know what to call it, but yeah, let's just be nice and say, let's call it a bylaw by the city during this period of crisis. There's a bylaw pending in fact, I just spoke to Ibrahim about it just before this. But yeah, I think you are obviously in the best position to give us a comprehensive explanation of what this bylaw is about. But maybe before you even talk about what the bylaw is about, you know, that one that's upsetting people so much at this point in time, maybe just give a definition of a bylaw.
Oh, the simplest definition, Hassan, is that a bylaw is a regulation or a rule which is made by a local government, a local authority, like a municipality. But you can also have bylaws made by corporations and companies and so forth. But this particular bylaw which we're talking about today is a draft amendment to the bylaw that was approved by the City of Cape Town on the 30th of May 2007. So it's just a definition, a set of rules and regulations, in this case specifically relating to streets, public places, and the prevention of noise nuisances.
Yeah, but now, if this bylaw was passed in 2007, why is it that they're wanting to, let's call it even, assault the public now? Because, I mean, just from what I've seen in terms of the objections from various organizations. I'm sitting here with a document here from Ground Up, as an NGO. There's Cape Civics Associations, there's Observatory Civic Association. I mean, I'm sitting here with all these documents, you know, from various organizations fighting this thing. So
yeah.
Now the question is, why is it that during this period of let's say swakre, you know, it's people are not working, some people are not even getting salaries, so, and people don't have time for this type of, you know, side issues, but this side issue can become a major issue. So maybe just give us an overview of what this bylaw seeks to do.
Well, I mean, I think it's suspicious that we are considering this bylaw, which essentially tries to criminalize poor people and to criminalize us, especially the homeless people, people who sleep on the streets and so on. And that we're having this discussion, Hassan, during the month of Ramadan when we reflect on the needs of the poor, the marginalized, and the indigent, because ultimately our sacrifices in fasting are about empathizing with the poor and with the marginalized. And I think it's appropriate during this particular month of Ramadan for us to actually focus on the substance and content of a bylaw that seeks to criminalize poor people. So what the bylaw of 2007 actually does is it speaks about the management of streets, public places, and noise nuisances and other related matters on all properties in Cape Town. Now, we're talking about public places, we're talking about streets. Noise nuisances often it relates to examples when our masajid make adhan. There have been numerous complaints, and we'll recall the more recent complaint that was lodged against the Muir Street Mosque, Zinatul Islam Masjid, in the Bukhab. That was, I think, last year. They were subjected to a complaint about the making of the adhan. It was around May or June 2019 when a complaint was filed against the Muir Street Masjid. Unfortunately, this bylaw doesn't exclude the ringing of church bells, the making of adhan, etc., etc. So noises are pretty much included in as potentially as nuisances and regulated under this particular bylaw of 2007. Now, what we're talking about today is a proposed amendment to that bylaw that was passed in 2007. And what this proposed amendment does is it aims to, they claim that it tries to streamline procedural aspects of the bylaw of 2007 that support and enable law enforcement officials to resolve complaints relating to noise and reducing risks to the City of Cape Town and individuals and landowners by ensuring that the processes and their actions are supported by legislation. So in essence, this draft amendment deals with enforcement and the recovery of costs. So say, for example, there's been building work or somebody's left a rubble on the side of the road, and the City of Cape Town comes along and they remove the rubble.
they can then not only issue a fine against the person who put the rubble there, perhaps your neighbor put it there on the side of the walk and it overlaps on your property. They can also come and impose a fine, but also recover costs for removing that rubble and then ask you to pay for the recovery of the cost. If people are sleeping on the streets and their goods have to be moved somewhere else, poor people, homeless people who have nothing to begin with can be fined for sleeping on the street. But in addition to that, for the removal of their goods, they can also, the City of Cape Town would want to recover costs under this particular draft amendment of the bylaw. But it goes further than that, Ihsan.
Mm-hmm.
It gives law enforcement officials extensive powers of inspections, instructions to, give them their power to just instruct people to leave places and so forth. There's an issue about compliance notices. And it speaks about authorizing officials, but it doesn't define who the authorizing official is or where they get the authority from and so on. But it just allows them to have extensive powers that are way above and beyond what even the South African Police Service has. Can you believe this?
Now, Ashraf, just before we go more into the substantive issues, let's just go back to the procedural issue quickly. Now, The constitution of this country gives, obviously, that's the mother document. You know, all laws derive from there. Of course, it gets tested, whether it's compliant with natural law, with all types of, laws. And then, of course, all legislation gets made by Parliament. There's a whole lot of processes involved. There's public participation. There's white papers. There's green papers. There's all these things. Now, what's the point of having a constitution that guarantees certain rights? And along comes a municipality, a local government, and then simply makes a bylaw that overrides what the constitution basically guarantees. For instance, freedom of movement. I mean, you say that some official can just tell you to move along. So, I mean,
why? But more than that, that official can actually arrest you, Ihsan. But your point is quite a valid point, because there are a number of constitutional rights in the Bill of Rights that are at stake here. You've mentioned freedom of movement being one of them. There's the freedom of security and freedom of person, the right not to be deprived of freedom arbitrarily, because people can just be arrested. You can have your cell phone snatched away by a law enforcement official and impounded under this particular amendment to the bylaw. Because the law enforcement official simply deems, who has a wide discretion, sees it as some kind of a threat to an act of unlawfulness or breach of the bylaw. So there are a number of constitutional issues, but the point I think that you want you're getting at, Ihsan, is that a bylaw does not trump the Constitution. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The rights and the freedoms that people enjoy ultimately trump all the other powers and functions that police officials even have under the law.
Mm.
And so this bylaw cannot come along and try to do what, try to take away the rights that are in the Constitution or in the Criminal Procedure Act by giving law enforcement officials extra powers of search and seizure, impounding property, instructing people to just move, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
The Constitution remains the supreme law.
Okay, Ashraf, if you don't mind, we're just going to break now for news and Janaza. Oh. Notes. If it's possible, then the technician can call you back rather for the last segment of this interview.
Okay. Shukran,
Ashraf. We'll speak to you.
My radio station, your radio station, our radio station, the Voice of the Cape.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour, and I just want to check if Ashraf is back on the line. Assalamu alaikum, Ashraf, you back with us?
Walaikum salam, Ihsan. Yes, thank you very much. I'm back.
Okay, shukran for coming back online. Ik weet is laat. And let's continue with this bylaw discussion, the bylaw that conflates a number of issues and is extremely broad. And, of course, it's going to be prejudicing a whole lot of people should the city succeed in passing it as law. So, again, continue, Ashraf.
Yes, so I mean, I think just to pick up on the thread that you raised earlier on the constitutional rights and so on, and I basically, in my submission on behalf of the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, focused on five particular rights that I thought was in breach. But of course, there are a whole range of other rights that are also in jeopardy. The one being security and freedom of person, which is in Section 12 of the Constitution. The right not to be deprived of freedom arbitrarily, when people can just be arrested, arbitrarily and so on. And in the city of Cape Town, under that particular, with that dispensation, they can simply impose a punishment, and they can determine the manner that the punishment is enforced. So law enforcement officials have got a wide discretion to be able to decide what to impose punishments and how that punishment must be enforced. But I think the real concerning thing is that they can impose fines, and that the imposition of a fine is a form of punishment rather than serving a regulatory purpose. You know, with bylaws must regulate conduct of people. But what this particular amendment does is it actually allows them to impose a fine, which is a form of punishment. So it goes way beyond what the regulatory scope actually allows for in the normal course. And that's quite problematic, Isan.
Okay.
So if there's a duty on the city of Cape Town to manage spaces and for example, if there's trees overhanging people's yards and people are putting their washing on the line, on the boundary fence, for example, or the main road or whatever, then law enforcement officials can come along and simply impound the clothes that are hanging on the washing on the fence. You know, people live in close proximity, especially in on the Cape Flats, and they use the little space that they have to the maximum. So you'll find that the lady may do the washing today, and she may just hang her washing on the boundary fence. Under those circumstances, the City of Cape Town official can just come there and grab that, impound that, all those clothes, and then she will have no leg to stand on. But then they will impose a fine on her and install the inconvenience of charging her the cost of having to remove all the stuff. I'm just giving you some examples of how people can suffer the consequences. But I think one of the big things that we focused on in the submission as well was on homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Because what this particular draft amendment does is it characterizes homeless people as a threat to public safety. And clearly, in so doing, the City of Cape Town fails to address their need for safety. By imposing punishment, they're not improving the safety of people, whether you're economically privileged or whether you're poor. How does imposing a punishment actually improve the issue of safety? You know, so the big concern, you know, from the perspective of the submission I've made, was how does this impact on poor people, particularly on the Cape Flats? And there are a number of concerns that we have. We take, for example, one of the stereotypes. They stereotype people who are released on parole, right? And they stereotype immigrants. And they basically say, and I mean, this is a statement that was released. I'm just trying to find the statement now that was released by J.P. Smith and a guy called Zaid Badruddin.
Mm-hmm.
They actually released a statement saying it's okay to issue fines, and they stereotype people who are released on parole, who may find themselves in the street with nowhere to go and sleep, even immigrants and so forth that may be left homeless and without any shelter. The problem with stereotyping is that people who are forced to sleep on the streets, if they stereotype, they don't have a choice to sleep on the streets. People don't simply decide today I'm going to sleep on the street. It's not a decision also that sleeping on the street can cause harm to other people. It's what people do to survive, you know. And for that kind of thing to be criminalized is quite problematic, Hassan.
Okay. No, definitely, Ashraf, I think what it looks like, and I'm checking with you, is this not just sorting out the symptoms of the real problem, and the real problem is poverty and homelessness, and
the real problem is housing, is the housing shortage.
Yeah.
And I think your point is that there's something that's sinister that underlies this particular draft amendment to the bylaw, especially when you consider the timing of it. And I think you raised that right at the beginning. Why now? Mm. When the parent bylaw was passed in 2007, why during the period of COVID-19 lockdown do they then introduce this bylaw and they open it up for public comment between the 17th of April in the midst of a lockdown and the 17th of May?
And not just any lockdown, a hard lockdown.
Lockdown, exactly.
Yeah. So look, I mean, Ashura, I just want to read quickly the disclaimer here that the views expressed in this program is not the views of the Voice of the Cape, is management or staff. I'm required by law to do that, so I'm doing it. But now I want you to tell me about, there's been certain organizations, you know, that actually focused on very narrow issues pertaining to this bylaw. And it almost then gives the impression, if there's agreement by the city on narrow issues, that they are okay with a broader issue.
Yes, no. I think you're probably referring to the controversy that erupted over the last couple of days involving the Muslim Judicial Council.
Yes.
And which involved a meeting between the MJC and the City of Cape Town on the 30th of April. So, Ihsan, that particular issue, that controversy was basically underscored by the fact that the MJC, when they saw this draft amended by law, they were obviously concerned. And they sent in a question to the City of Cape Town seeking clarity in relation to this concern, because obviously this concern affects a number of the masajid in the City of Cape Town. And the question they posed to the city was, will the amendments to the current bylaw, which is in particular Section 22 of the bylaw, affect the adhan or the call to prayer rendered from our masajid five times a day? What the City of Cape Town then did, they deployed two councillors. The one person is the chairperson of the Safety and Security Portfolio Committee, a councillor Nwake and Kavashe, and Councillor Aslam Kassim. I don't know these individuals, Ihsan. I don't hold a brief for them. But they apparently met with the MJC on the 30th of April. And obviously it was called a bear instance. And it was basically in response to the question that the MJC had posed to them around how this particular draft amendment would affect the adhan rendered from the masajid five times a day.
Okay,
and then what happened was they clarified that it doesn't affect the bylaw. They gave certain verbal undertakings that in terms of the interpretation, it doesn't affect the adhan. And then they agreed to issue a joint statement. But the joint statement, if you read the tone of the joint statement, which was issued on the 14th of May 2020, it almost appears from that joint that statement that there was support for the bylaw on this in general, but even though the MJC only raised a narrow issue in relation to the adhan. And I think that was quite disturbing and perhaps problematic, because it suggested that the MJC, which is a representative body of all Muslims in the Western Cape and all the masajid, is now speaking on behalf of all the Muslims.
I think that's maybe where the Muslim Judicial Council must be engaged once again, because I think it probably needed legal intervention and not necessarily only men of the cloth like the ulama, because when people say no, it's not, it will not affect the adhan five times a day, it could be true, but they will then also focus on how loud it is, the acoustics of that particular adhan. I mean, it's a historical, it's a cultural, it's a religious issue that people have the adhan. I mean, if it's in Woodstock, we can hear it in Woma Estate. If it's in Bukab, you can hear it in Central Town. So it doesn't limit the city from actually saying, no, you can't actually have the adhan that loud. Because there has been precedent set in Muir Street, I believe, and of course there has been an attempt to have it at Al-Azhar, where people wanted to come test the sound or how loud it is and whether it is in accordance with certain protocols. And I'm a bit concerned that even though they say, yes, it's okay for you to have your adhan, it will affect the loudness of that adhan if this bylaw goes through. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, and I agree with you. And I think that for the MJC to simply be hoodwinked by councillors who say on their interpretation the bylaw doesn't affect the adhan in general, I think that is highly problematic. And the point that you are making also is that there ought to have been broader consultation. Mm-hmm. But perhaps also speaking to legal experts who are knowledgeable about the interpreting of the laws, etc., etc. And that didn't happen. That apparently did not happen, because this bylaw seeks to change and give more powers and functions to law enforcement officials without even consulting the necessary experts and so forth, to simply enter into some kind of an agreement with two councillors in particular. And to say, well, and it doesn't affect, and so simply to issue a statement, that for me was quite problematic and disturbing.
Yeah, but as I say,
something needs to be said about that.
Yeah, but it's unusual. And I'm not defending the Muslim Judicial Council in this regard, but it's quite unusual for the Muslim Judicial Council to actually speak to government without actually referring to the legal people. So maybe that must be taken up with the Muslim Judicial Council again, because I'm a bit concerned when the city evaluates all the objections and people that support this particular piece of bylaw, whatever it may be called, then they will say, well, we have consulted with the Muslim Judicial Council and they represent 100 masajids, and of that 100 masajids, you're averaging about 500 people. So, you know, the overwhelming majority of people in the Western Cape, they are okay with this thing. So that's what I'm concerned about, and I think maybe that's something you should be able to take up with the Muslim Judicial Council and say, look, maybe you must relook at that particular statement and see if it flies, you know, with a broader consultation process.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely correct, Ihsan. And I think what we did over the weekend was we did precisely that.
Okay.
We reached out to the MJC through various individuals who are connected to the MJC, and we said to them, listen, man, the statement that you've issued creates the perception that you're actually supporting the bylaw. Which takes us back to the apartheid legislation with regard to search and seizure procedures and so on. And the question is, who is advising the MJC? It's a valid question you have to ask, because how could they simply enter into some kind of an arrangement without consulting the communities on such a draconian piece of a bylaw? If the issue of consultation was overlooked, then they should withdraw the statement. So we went to them and we asked them indirectly, listen, can you consider it? And alhamdulillah, I must say, some reason prevailed, and there was a subsequent statement that was issued, which is dated the 17th of May, where they clarified in a statement relating to the proposed bylaw that they're not supporting the proposed amended bylaw. They merely asked the question, how will the amendments affect the call to prayer, the adhan, rendered from the masjid 5 times a day? And they did reiterate that they wanted people to submit their comments and so forth. So I think they might not have retracted that statement, which created the perception, or the misperception, if I may say, but they did clarify that they did not support it. And I think that is good enough as far as I'm concerned.
No.
That some people within the leadership in the MJC are actually listening. But I think you point to the fact that the mistake ought not to have happened in the first place if there was adequate consultation with the appropriate people and the experts and the lawyers and so forth.
Yeah, but you know what, Ashraf, we're in the month of mercy. So maybe, you know, there's room for error, you know, and of course, rectification of error.
Are you saying that people were hungry when they made that decision?
Maybe, you never know. But the point I'm saying is, you know, I'm never too critical.
Is that your explanation?
No. I'm never too critical when people make decisions. it was, you know, in haste, you know. So you must basically understand maybe why it was done. And once you understand it, you could, and if there is still, you know, doubt, then you must basically, you know, look at how you're going to fix this problem. And I think it's a fixable problem because the legislation has not been approved yet.
So, subhanAllah, you're absolutely correct, and we have to give them the benefit. We don't have the explanation as to how it came about, and certainly the fact that they were able to revisit this and clarify the position does mean that people are listening and they are taking this quite seriously. So I think your point is quite valid. And we don't judge people harshly. I mean,
yeah, and then of course I just want people to understand. I'm just giving maybe a simple example besides the issue of Adhan. I mean, if you look at how people make Salah on a Jummah on a Friday, if I just look at the town area, if I look at the Al-Azhar Masjid in District 6, and if you look at the Long Street Masjid in the CBD, and, you know, where there's no space and people are forced to Salah outside in the street, effectively closing the street, you know, through Salah. So that's a type of activity that will not be allowed or tolerated via if this particular bylaw is actually approved. Because then, of course, the officials, as you mentioned earlier, they will simply be able to invoke their so-called powers. Is that correct?
I think you're correct. And I think the example of people making Salah, for example, in the CBD, that's often the practice in other mosques or people. There's an overflow of people that because the mosques are not big enough to accommodate people during Jummah or for Eid Salah, for example. And the concern that one has is that you have a meeting between the NGC and two particular councillors, politicians. They come to an understanding on their interpretation that this is what the bylaw means. It doesn't affect the Adhan or that kind of scenario that you're talking about, or accommodating people on the overspilling from the mosque onto the streets. But the point being that the bylaw still exists and needs to be enforced and regulated. People who are law enforcement officials won't rely on the interpretation of two councillors who met with the MJC or on this particular statement to say it doesn't affect them. They're going to read the letter of the law and they're going to say, well, the law says that you people are not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to make your Adhan.
Yeah,
they're going to enforce it.
Yeah, it's
so
like the lockdown.
It would be naive to suggest that you're simply on the say-so on the interpretation of two politicians that the law enforcement officials won't necessarily implement the law.
Well, the example could potentially be, you know, the current lockdown regulations. I mean, lawyers are struggling to keep up with the changes. Every single day there's a change. And, of course, if every time there's a change, there is a whole lot of interpretations of that change. Now, imagine the law enforcement officials that are not trained in law or in interpretation of statutes. They will just follow it in accordance with their very, very limited understanding of how the law is supposed to work by them reading it and taking the very literal meaning of what they see in front of them. And that, of course, you know, it strengthens the fear that you are currently, expressing. So therefore, you know, aside from the Muslim Judicial Council, maybe to have a re-look at what they agreed upon, or alternatively coming onto the show and explaining to the public what they actually agreed to and what their understanding was. And because the statement put out, the joint statement, is not very, very clear. And do you agree with that?
No, the statement is problematic. It had elements of ambiguity, but it also had, it created the misperception that there was MJC support for this particular bylaw. And that kind of approach was quite problematic. But they fixed it now, Ihsan. And I think we must accept that a mistake was made and that there was
When you say they fixed it, I mean, I'm not sure. Was there another statement released?
There was a statement subsequently released. So remember, the first statement was released on the 14th of May.
Okay.
That was a statement that was quite problematic, right?
Yeah.
And then subsequent to that, over the weekend, there were certain interventions after we saw the initial statement and we raised concerns about the misperception that the MJC is now speaking on behalf of all Muslims in support of this particular bylaw. Then on the 17th, which was 2 days ago, the MJC then issued another statement saying clarity, it is titled Clarity Regarding the MJC's Joint Statement with the City of Cape Town. And I must say, you know, it's sufficient clarification as far as I'm concerned. It's a minimalist clarification. I'm sure they could have said a lot more by distancing themselves, but they did indicate there that they don't support the bylaw. It must not be construed as such, and I think it should be accepted as a rectification of the first statement.
Yeah, I think it will be very useful then to have the MJC on Voice of the Cape, just giving us an account of
an explanation.
And I think that will suffice if at the end of it, you know, as long as the intention to actually challenge certain aspects, even the whole bylaw, you know, if it prejudices anybody, especially the poor of this and the homeless. Because I think that by supporting a bylaw that prejudices the poor and the homeless, that flies in the face of everything that we are about as a community.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But I think you know, in the submission that I've made also is that besides focusing on the homeless and the impact of this bylaw on the homeless, what we've also considered is the relationship that exists between the city that the city of Cape Town has in regulating public spaces and its decision to use criminal investigative techniques of search and seizure. So that relationship needed to be unpacked. And I think that if organizations like the NJC had spoken to lawyers, they would have been made aware that there are these inconsistencies and these relationships that exist. But, you know, so clearly there are a number of pitfalls and mine, you know, problematic areas in the draft law. It's not just about the Adhan, and I think that's the point that I want to bring across. And to take a narrow view to say we're only concerned with the Adhan, when they know that they represent, people in the poor communities on the Cape Flats and so forth who are going to be impacted, was a very perhaps a short-sighted view. And I think your invitation to the MJC to come on air and to explain is a good one. I hope that they take up that opportunity going forward.
Ashraf, you're talking about, just representing the poor on the Cape Flats and... you'll be surprised to know that in the CBD area, like, you know, just in the District 6, Woodstock, Salt River area, there is more than 200 Muslims that are actually sleeping on the street that's actually homeless. I mean, so it will affect all these people, whether we like it or not, you know, this bylaws. I think we should use that as a starting point. It's not only affecting the poor who's living in homes, but it's also affecting the homeless who's actually also Muslim.
So I'm gonna share something quite shocking with you now. I mean, just for the city of Cape Town, I mean, I'm speaking to people, organizations like U-Turn that work with homeless and so forth. On their statistics that they provided, they're saying that there are approximately 2,500 shelter beds within the city. In other words, the Haven Night Shelter and others, other institutions are able to take in 2,500 people. But on any given moment, there are about 6,000 homeless street people in the city, which means that there's a shortage. It means that people don't have a choice. There will always be people on the street for as long as there are not insufficient beds. And when you talk about 200 Muslim people in that area that you're talking about, Woodstock and so on, I would actually venture to say, you know, that it's the numbers are much higher if you look across the Cape Flats, Iksan. But those statistics are actually quite shocking. But the point I want to also make is that criminalizing homelessness through bylaws such as this, where people, if they lack money and employment, and that is the reason for being on the street, giving someone a criminal record makes it even harder for them to get a job.
Yeah, they'll become unemployable.
Exactly. If trauma and abuse is the reason why people are on the street, the anxiety and trauma faced of receiving a fine and then being taken to court makes it even harder to work
with someone rehabilitatively. So you can't rehabilitate people like that. Mm. Finding people who have no job, who have no money, and no means to pay is completely counterintuitive, Ihsan. Mm. And so the underlying premise of this bylaw is quite problematic because of the punishment that it imposes.
Mm. Okay, excellent. Thank you, shukran very much, Ashraf, for the insight into this bylaw. I think this is still a debate that must be carried through, on many forums, and of course on the radio station will obviously keep a very, very close eye on this bylaw. And shukran for honoring us with your presence tonight on air.
Shukran to you and Ramadan and Eid Mubarak to all the listeners, and may Allah guide and protect us for the remaining days of Ramadan, and may we benefit from Laylatul Qadr, inshallah, and Allah accept all our du'as, inshallah. And shukran to you for hosting me. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
My radio station, your radio station, our radio station, the voice of the Cape.
The Legal Hour with Ihsan Higgins.
And we are back with the Legal Hour and last segment, last few minutes of this program. We've got online with us none other than old regulars, Faisal Bardi. Assalamu alaikum, Faisal.
Alaikum salam, Ihsan, all of the VOC listeners.
Shukran, Faisal. And then we've got also Nazir Park. Assalamu alaikum, Nazir.
Wa alaikum salam, Ihsan, VOC listeners, and to Faisal as well.
Okay, so it's nice to speak to both of you from different magisterial districts. Nazir, of course, being there in the northern suburbs, and Faisal being in the southern suburbs, and we're speaking to him from town. So, So, gentlemen, we are now on day 50-something of the of the lockdown.
You're still counting, Ihsan.
I'm still counting every single day, and I was actually like almost celebrating on the 50th. Day. And I couldn't believe that, we started it. It almost feels like it was the other day. It went very, very quick. So, but in any case, Faisal, your current views on what's happening at the moment? Is there any new regulations, new law?
I just want to say, Ihsan, you had two good segments before us. Very interesting, very informative. And unfortunately, we must make me apologize to the listeners now beforehand, because the regulations is always a boring, a boring segment. So, but we need to deal with it and clarify. But alhamdulillah, that was two good segments you had before this.
Shukran for that.
Yeah. So, with the new regulations, what I wanted to just bring to the attention of the listeners is the with regard to the movement of people in event of them having to relocate to new premises, whether it's residential or business. So the first one that came out was on the 7th of May, right? And that had a limited time period until the 7th of June, whereby if you were moving house or moving business, you could move during that period until the 7th of June. And then obviously there was consultation with government, et cetera, and they obviously thought, hold it, it's not going to work until the 7th of June. We need to open this up. And then they came out with a new regulation, which was then published on the 14th of May 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So what it basically means is that if you need to move house because your lease ended, you need to then vacate and move to a new premises, or you bought a premises or a property, and the transfer took place and you now need to move into your new property that you purchased. This regulations give you the right to move yourself and your furniture, fixtures, etc. Not fixtures, sorry. It's furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And your goods with you, so long that you have a valid permit with you.
And so, is this across provinces, or is it just within the province?
This is across provinces also. So if you're relocating to another province and you bought or you're going to lease in that premises on that side, then you can relocate. But you need to go to your local police station. And then when you go to your local police station, And I just want to mention and talk about this form that you need to get the police to sign and stamp, which is called Form 1 under Direction 3B.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the permit that we're talking about. So your details will be filled in this permit, where you, you know, where you're currently residing and where you're going to be moving to, and also who's helping you to move, whether it's a family friend or whether it is a removal service. That details all go into there. And also you need to have your documentation, which is either your lease agreement or, they say, your title deed.
Mm.
And let me just warn the listeners that, you know, you might not have your title deed because the deeds office was closed. Mm. So that title deed might still be lying at the deeds office, so you might not have that
document. But Faisal, even during normal time, if it wasn't locked down, it doesn't happen immediately. It takes a couple of months before your title deed gets to
there
you.
There we go, and that's why I'm alerting the listeners. It'll take you between 3 and 6 weeks to get that title deed. So what do you do in the alternative is that you would get your conveyancer to issue you a conveyancing certificate. And that certificate gets signed and stamped by the conveyancer, who confirms that the transfer took place on such and such a date, and this is the new owner of the property.
Mm.
You know, if they have captured the deed on their microfilm in a deed office, they could then also, you could maybe print a copy of it. Not have the original, you might have a copy printed, but that depends on whether the deeds office has uploaded that microfilm copy onto their system in order for you to get a copy of it.
Okay.
So your best bet would be a conveyancing certificate.
Faisal, I just want to get to Nazir quickly. Nazir, what happens now? I mean, and I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball now. Because if Cape Town, or rather, let's say the Western Cape stays under level 4, and let's say Free State moves to level 3, then, and you have to move house to Free State, surely it doesn't make sense for somebody coming out of a level 4 province to move to a level 3 province. What is your thoughts on that?
Sean, you know, we're speculating that it will remain a level 4, but I support you there. I think theory suggests that. But ultimately, in the end of the day, in the event that we are going to be moving interprovincially and from a level 4 province to a level 3 province, I don't think there's much logic that dictates that it should happen. But as Faisal said, now you've got all of these adjusted regulations that does allow for this interprovincial travels under certain circumstances. So irrespective, in my mind, whether it's going to be a level 4 province or a level 3 province, I think it will still be permissible under those strict terms and conditions.
Hmm. And okay, Nazir, just your favorite topic, the cigarette topic. myself and Faisal, we've never smoked, so for us it's not appropriate even to speak about cigarettes. So, but just tell me quickly, some listener phone, I mean, shame, people are like really wanting to smoke. Imagine you, I mean, I know of a whole lot of people, you know, immediately after they break their fast, they run outside and they go light up a cigarette. Now imagine you break your fast, you list for that cigarette all day, and then you realize after you've broken your fast that you don't have cigarettes.
that's unfortunately the reality with many people these days, Hassan. Unfortunately, with regard to the cigarette scenario, there doesn't seem to be much clarification from either the tobacco manufacturers or from the government at this point in time. The ban very much remains intact. And unfortunately, I mean, I see it happening on in practice that the illicit cigarette trade has picked up tenfold, and unfortunately, the pricing is ridiculous. It's absolutely more than 1,000% increased in terms of the value of a packet of product.
Nazir, so, I had an interesting encounter the other day. Somebody, one of the fishmongers, came outside. I could hear the horn, and of course I went out to go check what fish this person has. And then he tells me, but it could end Sisuk, you know, like. And then for interest, I asked him, no, hoeveel is he inches? And then he told me it was 170 rand a packet of 10.
Wow.
170 rand for a packet of 10. And to find, so, you know, what is it, Stuyvesant of Rothmans? And then he gave me some strange name, you know, like I've never heard of Kingston or something like that. And I thought to myself, that same cigarette probably cost 20 rand and in normal times.
That's
and
great.
He wanted 170 rand. So the black market is obviously booming right now.
It is, Ishan, and that's the difficulty. I think that the financial brains of the country, especially in the ministerial sections, are sweating about because they're losing out on a lot of syntax on the cigarette trade. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I stand to be corrected. I know that there was a tentative date for the 26th of May for the application brought by the cigarette manufacturers to finalize that particular aspect for the lifting of the ban, albeit I'm not sure whether that date is secured or whether they've just amended their timelines for the hearing of the matter. But the application hasn't been abandoned at this point in time. It's still very much intact.
Yeah. Okay, Faisal, just your final comment. I think we've now exhausted our time.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention also, just to inform the listeners about the Deeds Office. You know, the Deeds Office opened on the 13th of May, 2020. However, today we got a notice that there has been a suspension with regard to lodging new deeds in the Deeds Office as from tomorrow onwards. So it feels that we're going back to square one as far as moving forward. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this suspension is going to be lifted soon. I believe it's got to do with the issue of, having proper PPE and sanitization of the building.
They probably didn't comply with safety regulations.
Could be. That's what I'm reading between the lines, yeah. But then the master's office is open also. However, it's skeleton staff type of thing. You can't do consultations or anything. You have to do everything through letters, etc. So that's what's happening on that too.
Okay, fronts. Shukran. That has to do with the deeds office and the master's office. So for those people that was worried about the estates and the wills and such things. So, of course, there is some movement at the master's office at this point in time. Nazir, your final comment?
Ishan, just to touch on what Faisal was speaking about, I just want to advise the listeners that a lot of people have been asking me what the movement amendments to the regulations have impacted the eviction orders that maybe have been obtained prior to lockdown. At this moment in time, the eviction orders and the enforcement of the eviction orders remain suspended. So unfortunately, until such time that the powers that be changes that, eviction orders cannot be enforced.
Nazir, you say unfortunately. Unfortunately for landlords, but fortunately for those people that don't have anywhere to go.
No, it's a balanced thing at the moment.
Of course. Okay, but guys, shukran very much, Faisal Bardin and Nazir Parker, for gracing us with your presence at this hour and giving us very, very valuable information. So shukran very much, and I want to greet both of you. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
So for the listeners, shukran very much for giving us an opportunity to serve this wonderful community. I want to say to everybody, please be safe. Please look after your loved ones. If you need to, go out for urgent things. Otherwise, stay at home. Try to avoid this COVID disease. I've got personal friends that actually were declared positive. I'm shocked. I'm still in shock, actually, that I was, speaking to this person on that particular day, and the evening I get an SMS to say that he has been, he is positive for COVID. So it's real out there. It's not something that, it's not the Illuminati or the people that is the strange forces that's putting it out there. It's real. So please, people, look after yourselves. I want to say to everybody, have a wonderful Eid. I will obviously only be speaking to you after Eid. So have a safe and wonderful Eid, and be blessed.